Our theme for today is living with limitations, personal and planetary. And what I'd like to try to do is to begin by sharing some things about living with personal limitations and to use that as a kind of introduction into the wider topic of living with planetary limitations. And I think as we talk about these things and move into this, we see at once that we're dealing with things that are of personal interest and I'm sure vital interest to every one of us. That in one way or another, as we touch upon these things, we are dealing with things that affect and touch each one of our lives. Now, I'd like to start in a rather personal way and say that I think that the problem of living with personal limitations is certainly a personal problem for me. And I have a hunch it's also a personal problem for each one of us. How do we come to terms with this? One of the problems that my wife and I, for example, wrestle with, she's a public school teacher and I'm a pastor, and as I mentioned, the University Lutheran Church of Hope in Minneapolis. One of the problems, I think probably the most difficult problem we've had to deal with, is the problem of managing time. We live with limited time. Each one of us, of course, has the same number of hours and minutes every day, and yet the pressures are on us. And in our situation, where my wife is a public school librarian, has responsibilities from Monday through Friday, and I occasionally have a few things going on Saturday and Sunday, you can understand that the management of time gets to be sometimes a very difficult problem. And that illustrates, I mentioned that in our own life, because we all live with limited time. We recognize we are finite people. We have hopes and dreams. There are lots of things we want to do. And we discover before we've lived too long that there are a lot of things we're not going to be able to do. Dr. Gerhard Frost, I don't know if they have any of his books in the bookstore. You could check for some of those if they're there or someplace else. I think a very helpful author. It talks about the experience of standing at the deathbed of a dream. I'm sure all of us have had experiences of that kind. We live with limited time. We live with limited ability. Some of us are very conscious many times of our limited ability in all departments, mental ability and emotional and physical and all the rest of it. We are forgetful. We meet people. We forget their names. And there are some people at Hope Church think I'm a genius because I've never forgotten their names. There are other people think I'm a complete ding-a-ling, an idiot, because I seem like I can never remember their names. And I don't know why it is. Some people, I learn to meet them, and I get their name, and it sticks. Other people, over and over again, we have this frustration of limited ability. We struggle to understand, to make meaning out of, to make sense and meaning out of life. I often think of a quotation from an English preacher of 100 years and more ago, F.W. Robertson, who said that we are here to live and to die. In a few years, it will all be over. In the meantime, what we have to do is to try to understand and to help one another understand what it all means, what this strange and mysterious thing called life contains within it. And as we think of people like Einstein seeking somehow in theory of relativity to comprehend something of the basic physical universe, we seek to comprehend the meaning of life and of the world and what it means to be here. And we know that we're up against the limits of our ability. I have a good friend, Charles Anderson, who's now the president of Augsburg College, who taught for many years. I was on the faculty of Luther Seminary with him. And one time after he had demonstrated a great feat of memory or whatever it was, I kidded him a little bit and I said, "It must really be something to be omniscient. And that is all-knowing." And he said to me, "Oh, no," he said, "there's a lot of difference between omniscience and total recall." Well, there is a big difference between omniscience and total recall. There's a great difference. And for those of us who have nowhere near total recall, we recognize our limitations also in that department. Each one of us, I suppose, in some ways, think of abilities. We may think of ourselves as having some disability, whatever it is. We think back over our life experience. Part of my personal history involves a couple of things I'll just mention in passing. One is that when I was 2 years old, I had polio. Spent part of my childhood in Gillette Hospital for crippled children, as they used to call it in those days in St. Paul. You get kind of an interesting self-identity when you go into a place that is labeled as a place for crippled children. I'm grateful that I had a very mild case of polio, and I don't think too much about it, except once in a while people ask me if I've sprained my ankle or something, and when I pay the bill for my tailor-made shoes, the last one cost $240 for one pair, then I think about it a little bit, though I keep resoling the shoes and all that, so I probably spend less on shoes in a lifetime than many others of you do, I don't know. But that, again, is part of your limitations of your life. It has effect upon you. More significant for me, and my parents had related to that, was experience with stuttering. Part of my neurotic history involves stuttering. They say that alcoholics should never speak of themselves as alcoholics in the past tense. So those of us who are stutterers probably should not think of ourselves as stutterers in the past tense either. We could spend a whole half a day here, I'm sure, talking about stuttering. I think that's a very fascinating subject. And I may even touch a little bit on that tomorrow morning in terms of our Bible study theme by way of illustration. But these are our limitations that come into our life. When I was in grade school and junior high, I thought that stuttering was the only problem in the world. I have since learned there are many other problems in the world, and there are some occasions when I do still have a little trouble with stuttering, and it helps me to talk about it, which is one reason why I occasionally share that with people. Stuttering is what a person does to keep from stuttering. A stutterer is a person who cannot speak non-fluently. They're paradoxical statements, but stuttering happens when you try too hard to speak fluently. I never stuttered when I talked with a dog because the dog didn't care. I stuttered when I wanted to speak fluently. There's a lot of interesting implications of that. I may, as I say, touch upon that again tomorrow morning. But that's anyway, just a way to illustrate, we have these kind of limitations. We have other kind of limitations. There are people who really agonize. Most of us, any of us wealthy enough to come to Holden Village, probably don't have, struggling for our very existence economically, financially, materially. There's an old saying, it's no sin to be poor, but it's a terrible inconvenience. And for some people, of course, it's much more than inconvenience. It's an agonizing problem that preoccupies their whole life. And those of us who haven't had that experience need to think about it. My wife and I were on a study leave earlier this year out in Boston, and one day we'd forgotten to cash a check, and we had only a few places there we could cash, so we had no money left. And I had, a few coins in my pocket, and we had a few days to go ahead. We were not in any great problem. We could get along. There was some stuff in the refrigerator. But, we didn't even stop to think about it. And think about people for whom that's their everyday existence. Most of us here aren't wealthy people, but I think there's something there, again, for us to think about. Anyway, we live with limitations. And these limitations come to us in all kinds of ways. I think that many of us think that we are the only ones in the world who have limitations. We look around us and other people always seem to be so adequate and so able. I was struck by a comment that Sandy Mays made yesterday when we were talking about some of these things. And you correct me if I don't get this quite right, about how you were talking with your mother and you asked your mother, do you ever feel you're not good enough? Was that something like that? And she said, all the time, or something like that. We feel we're the only ones that don't measure up. And yet, one of the convictions that has grown in my life as I've lived just a little over a half century now is that though the specifics of our life situations are often very different, that we're still very much alike on the inside. We have very similar kind of situations, and one of those is that we are forced in our life experience to face the fact that we are limited creatures. I heard Dr. Gerhard Frost, who I mentioned before, make the comment once at a kind of a retreat of our faculty at the seminary. He said that for about the first, I don't know how many years of his life, he said, I was a coper. I was able to cope with things in my own strength. And then he said we got into some situations, and he didn't go into all the details. That probably isn't important anyway. He said, I simply could not cope anymore. I was not adequate in my own strength. And it's in those times, of course, we think of the experience, for example, of the Apostle Paul, who was quite a coper too. And then he discovered, he got up against some things that were more than he could handle, and through that experience, he learned to find his strength not in himself, but in the grace of God. And sometimes we don't make that kind of discovery or whatever we want to put it, we continue to pretend that we are masters of our fate and captains of our soul. Somebody has said, I read one time, someone, I don't know who it was, who said the best day in my life was the day when I resigned from being chairman of the board of the universe. And I think that, you know, in terms of living with limitation, we recognize we are not God. We don't live very well as God. By the grace of God, we can live rather well as human beings. Now, how do we deal with this? And we could take just quit here and not go into the whole second half of this thing. I don't want to do that. I want to go through this and then give us time to talk about it. There are things, of course, that come to mind, and I want to just mention a few things. Some of these may seem almost to be platitudinous. They're kind of sermonic kind of answers to these questions of living with personal limitations. And yet I think there's truth in them. And we need to be reminded of them. I heard someone say once that each one of us has been given enough ability and enough time to do what God wants us to do. That's an interesting statement. Platitudinous, perhaps. God has not promised to give us enough time to do what everybody wants us to do. He hasn't given me enough time to do everything that everybody at University Lutheran Church of Hope wants me to do. Or everything that, you know, I want to do, or maybe my wife or family want us to do, but he's given us enough time to do what he wants to do, and enough ability to do it. I think that's really what basically counts in life. I underscore again that word of the Apostle Paul, that great promise, my grace is sufficient for you. My power is made perfect in weakness. When I am weak, then I am strong. That can sound like a platitude, but it can be just nothing less than revolutionary in our life if we really take that in. We've heard it said many times, we don't have to be successful, we only have to be faithful. And again, there is profound truth in that. I heard Lowell Santry once, professor at Luther Seminary, preach his chapel sermon on that text about Jesus who went from, you know, he talks about how he went this day and tomorrow and the day after, continuing his work. And Satri preached on the theme of learning to plod. Taking one day at a time, doing what we're able to do in each day. Doing it as well as we can, but remembering also, and this is one of my little mottos, and don't take this wrong, but I share it with you. One time I was talking with a guy in a fifth step for Alcoholics Anonymous, and he made the comment that he'd come to believe that anything worth doing was worth doing poorly. That's helpful for those who are obsessive compulsive perfectionists. I don't think it's very helpful for people sort of inclined to be sloppy in the first place. But if we are so obsessed with perfection, then we're in a problem. I heard someone make a distinction between excellence and perfection. Excellence, yes. That we strive for. Perfection, no. We can't strive for that. I mean, we can strive for it, but we're not going to succeed at it. We're always going to be short of perfection. And so there's a sense in which it is true that anything worth doing is worth doing poorly. We think about Jesus taking those few loaves and fishes and feeding the multitudes. And we think of one of the meanings of that, of taking our lives, ordinary lives such as ours, and that he can take them and use those lives. Harry Emerson Fosdick had a great theme, I think, that which he said that we do not need to be great in ourselves to stand for something great. We don't need to be great in ourselves. Use the illustration, to carry a great flag. We have a representative capacity. We're called to be witnesses. We can point to Christ. And we don't have to be great in ourselves to be used by a great God, to let God use us and bless us, to take these lives of ours and to use them for something in the world. Anyway, that's a little rambling kind of introduction here in terms of this whole matter of living with personal limitations. And I don't want to stop here yet. If you have urgent things you want to come in with, you could do that. But I'd like to go on from that to move to the area of planetary limitations. And I want to run through some things there, and then I hope we have time to talk about this whole subject, whether it is personal or planetary. And in terms of the planetary limitations, I want to begin with an illustration, and I want to talk about a book. The illustration may seem kind of strange, but it to me is a very meaningful one. Some years ago, we were out to San Diego and went to the zoo there, and we saw something I'd never seen before anywhere. Maybe you've seen this somewhere. That was in the zoo. They had a mouse house that was made of a loaf of bread, a big loaf of bread. And they had a little sign up there that you could make this particular kind of bread at a certain recipe for the bread. My wife's a public school librarian, as I mentioned. She got back home. They had some white mice, etc., over there in the library. And so she made a big loaf of bread. And you cut some holes in the side of it and so on, and you turn the mice loose in there. And those mice live in that loaf of bread. Now, you can imagine what those mice do with that loaf of bread. They, of course, eat it, for one thing. But they also waste it, and they pollute it, and they mess up the thing. And so after some days, this big, beautiful loaf of bread is just all, you know, it's scattered all around. And, of course, if, you know, one just let those mice live on that loaf of bread, I mean, after a while, I mean, those mice finally are going to starve to death unless you take out that loaf of bread and you put in a new loaf of bread. Now, I use that as an illustration because what I'm talking about in terms of this book is suggestive of the fact that we are like those mice living in our loaf of bread. But in our situation, there's nobody on the outside to give us a new loaf of bread. When we have devoured and polluted and wasted the loaf of bread in which we live, namely the earth in which we live, nobody's going to come along and put a new loaf of bread in for us. And so I think that is a tremendously, to me, maybe to anybody else, meaningful illustration of something which increasingly to me becomes one of the central and main themes of my life. I thought of it this morning, early as we were pondering some of these things, that I think one of the key concepts, seems to me, unifying concepts, is the concept of stewardship of life. Schweitzer talked about reverence for life. I think that's very important. You need to go beyond reverence, the stewardship, taking responsibility. And I think that stewardship of life relates to our concern related to the arms race and the possible annihilation of life on the planet. It relates to our personal lives, the care of our health and all of that. It relates to the care of the earth. We're dealing here with a very basic Christian theme of stewardship of life itself. And I use that mouse house as a way of getting into that. Now, the book I want to talk about, and I'd like to put something up on the board, though I'm not very good to writing it on the board. It's a book that I read during this study leave time, and I don't have a copy of the book with me, but I've got a lot of notes here, and I want to, as part of introducing you to this, maybe some of you have seen the book. It's called Entropy. I've never written on this. This is really smooth, this place to write. And the book is by a guy by the name of Jeremy Rifkin. So anybody here read that book? He had another book a few years ago. This book was published by Viking Press in 1980. And it has the subtitle, A New World View. The book that he wrote a few years ago, the book called The Emerging Order, was a rather hopeful book in many ways. He thought that, especially in terms of the Christian church, there really was a revival of interest with some of these same issues he deals with here. In this book, I don't think he's quite as hopeful. I want to say just a little bit about this by way of introduction and then quote some things out of the book and then open it for discussion for us. First thing I want to say about this, as we get into this, I hope that Rifkin is wrong. Because what he deals with is not a very pleasant thing to contemplate. And I just say that by way of preface. You might keep that in mind as we go through this. If you say, I don't agree with this, as I share some of these things, and he's wrong, I'd be very happy to have you convince me that he's wrong. There are people who take a very different stand. But what he really says, just to give a little summary, is really the kind of thing I've been talking about in the mouse house, that we are destroying the planet in which we live, and we are, by the way we live now, we are depriving not necessarily immediately our own selves, but our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of the possibility of a livable planet and a future with potential of fullness of life. Another way of maybe illustrating that would be, I think that he would say that if the people back in Egypt during the time of the years of plenty had lived in the way in which we are living now, that they would likely all have starved to death. But fortunately, there was Joseph came along. And he doesn't use this terminology, but I think he says, in effect, what this world needs now is 1,000 or 10,000 or 100,000 Josephs, people who will face the situation we are in and help us, lead us, to act in ways that can give a future for us. Now, among the people who take a different point of view are people such as Julian Simon, who's written a book called The Ultimate Resource, and I also read this book. This is for a page torn out of Forbes magazine. This says that the Ultimate Resource book is the most refreshing, inspiring, revolutionary, and sound writing on energy, resources, pollution, and population not written. I must confess, I wish I could believe it. I don't think so. I think that Simon is whistling in the dark. The ultimate resource is human imagination, ingenuity. He is saying, in effect, don't worry about these things. We can solve the problems. Rifkin says about that, that is like a person who has just fallen off the 100th floor of a building, and as the person goes by the 50th floor, person says to himself, everything is all right so far, I think it's going to be just fine. Maybe everything seems all right so far, but I don't think that this is very helpful. They have another book, by the way, they review here, which makes this just an aside to this, a book called Conquest of Death, which says that most of those alive today who are under 50 will probably cheat death. And they mean this literally. People want to, you will not die. You're going to, and they put that book in their list also. I think that is maybe no more realistic than the other book. Anyway, now what are we talking about when we talk about entropy? Well, I have a definition. I did bring a dictionary. And I want to read a definition from that. Entropy, a measure of the degree of disorder in a substance or a system. Entropy always increases and available energy diminishes in a closed system as the universe. Now, I don't want to get into all kinds of things, you know, complicated about this, that the first law of thermodynamics, as I understand it and try to sum it up, others of you scientifically minded put it much better than I could, is that the matter energy of the universe is a constant, but the second law of thermodynamics says that though the total remains constant, the form changes, and the point of the entropy business is that the changes in the energy resources of the world change from the usable to the useless, from the available to the unavailable, from the ordered to the disordered. Let me just give an illustration of that. That is to say, if we have here before us a lump of coal, for example, or a gallon of oil, there we have usable, available energy. That coal and oil really is the energy of the sun that has been transformed through plant processes and millions of years and all of that into what is now for us available energy. But if we put that coal here into the fireplace and we burn it and the smoke goes up and so on, it is no longer either usable or available to us. You put that oil, you know, make gasoline out, put it in your car and we drive and it is no longer available. We transform that which is usable to the unusable, the available to the unavailable. And that basically in this, what we have here is a challenge to the whole concept of growth and progress. It's a challenge in many ways to science and to technology. Rifkin claims that though it seems to us that the more in which we, you know, we do material, we have material progress, and you have the example here's the waste wilderness, and a farmer comes in there with his tractor, and he plows up the ground, and here you have a fertile garden growing where only weeds and so on grew before, or you have civilization grows up out of the midst of wilderness, and it appears as if you really have progress there. But what he's talking about is something much more basic, and that is the cost of that particular kind of progress. And what I want to do is to go through and just cite some quotations out of this book, which I hope can be helpful for us, and then to open it up for discussion and sharing. And here I'm going to rely on my own notations and to share a few references from the book. And I take these now in the order in which I took them as I read the book, so that this may seem a bit rambly, but I think it will give a picture of what we are talking about here. This statement, for example: it is possible to reverse the entropy process in an isolated time and place, but only by using up additional energy in the process and thus increasing the overall entropy of the environment. That is to say, as a farmer, for example, uses the example of coming in and prepares the field and, you know, grows a beautiful crop and so on. There you have, in one local area, you have, in a sense, reduced entropy. You have created order out of disorder. But what he is saying is, when you figure out the total cost of that, the amount of gasoline that has been used and everything else that has gone into producing that, overall there is in some sense a loss. In a closed system, he says, the material entropy must ultimately reach a maximum. It moves only in one direction. And that we cannot stop entropy, but we can. This, of course, is the key to what he, in the positive things he goes on to suggest, is we can affect its speed. And as I'm tempted to stop here and comment, but I want to read these quotations first, or specific points. They aren't all direct quotations, and then we have time for some comments. Concerning the food chain, for example, he suggests that every life that lived in the world leaves the world poorer in energy than we found it. That's interesting, because we talk about living. It's more than interesting, it's challenging. We talk often about, so live in such a way you leave the world a little better than you found it. He says, in terms of energy and the basic resources of life, that is not really possible for us. And he talks about how, in terms of our civilized technological scientific society, that we use up many, many, many times the amounts of energy that were used by our parents and our grandparents and those who have lived before us. And the great stress, really, of this whole book is a call and challenge to live within the limits, and limits looking also toward the future. Only by consciously choosing to respect the physical confines of the closed system, the earth on which we live, can we make the radical adjustment that is essential for the continuation, for our continuation as a species. Our survival and the survival of all other forms of life now depends on our willingness to make peace with nature and begin to live cooperatively with the rest of our ecosystem. And he talks about what this means in terms of, and here we get into, already here, though it comes more later, in terms of what this means for us, in terms of travel and heat and the way we eat and all this kind of business. We think of technology as being, and science as being, the solution to our problems. He thinks of it in many ways, depending on the type of it, of course, as being the cause of many of our problems. We have in the energy, for example, in coal and oil, millions of years of stored solar energy. All the energy of the earth comes either from two sources, either from the sun, and that is not just, of course, in direct solar energy, but in the wood in the fireplace because of the sun, the water that falls here, that runs the hydro and so on, that solar power, the sun has evaporated the water and it's created that cycle and so on. It is solar or it is nuclear. Now, there are some people who think the cure to all of this, and the reason they hope and believe that Rifkin is wrong, is because in the nuclear area, fission or fusion, there will be solutions to these problems. He is not very hopeful about that, and he says that even if the energy aspect can be dealt with, the energy, of course, is only one part of the total overall resource picture, and what is illustrated in terms of what's happening in energy, he believes also is happening in other areas. He's not very hopeful as far as the so-called synthetic fuels, because he believes it takes more energy to produce them, more water to produce them, than is worth in the process. He talks about how this is not a question of, you know, capitalism, socialism, communism, and so on. He maintains that the great societies of the earth and most other the developing countries are moving, he thinks, in the wrong direction too. This is something which affects both socialism and capitalism, which are essentially materialistic societies, see progress in terms of the growth and material use of things and so on, and that he believes this also is flies in the face of this basic entropy law that means that we just simply cannot continue to go on and living this way. He talks about how a diet for the average person is about 2,000 calories a day, and yet in the United States, for example, that the way in which food is produced, the way we use the electricity for not only food production, but for heating and transportation and for food processing, all of that, we are probably expending about 200,000 calories a day, and that 225 million people in the United States are using, in effect, enough calories to feed 22 billion people. He talks about how a can of corn contains 270 calories. The farmer to produce that can of corn uses, and they calculate the cost again of the total production, harvesting, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, canning and everything else, about 2,790 calories. It's in a way what he would say, it's spending $10 to get a dollar return. You are eating the house. You're living on your capital. He uses an illustration, for example, about how we have an English muffin for breakfast. And you think about that English muffin, and you think about where it comes from, and how you think about the farmer out there. He's planting this before he plants, of course. He plows the field and prepares the soil, and he's out there, he plants it, and he does the things that are necessary, and he puts on fertilizer on the thing, and then he has to harvest it, and it's shipped to town, and it's ground up, and it is put in the oven, and you bake it, and then it's, you know, there are some wrappings that are plastic that's put around it, and then it's shipped someplace, and you get in your car, and you don't have any English muffins, and so you drive a mile and a half over to the store and you buy a quart of milk and an English muffin kind of thing. And you come home and then you put it in your toaster and the electricity is toasting the thing. And by the time you get whatever number of energies out of that thing, you can just imagine the tremendous amount of energy that's gone into it. And he said that was a kind of illustration of the kind of problem we are dealing with here. And that... He talks about the tremendous also waste of energy in ways that he believes are non-productive. He has an interesting section dealing with how, you know, what we have to do now, because we have so many things, we have to protect them and preserve them, and so we build this tremendous military establishment, and that again is the using, among other things, of tremendous amounts of energy to protect and preserve what we have. I mentioned the other day that I think that one of the moral equivalents, they talk about, William James wrote an article back in 1910 or so, that we need to have what he called the moral equivalent of war. I think one moral equivalent of war, that is something that calls for our sacrifice, dedication, commitment, as it would be if we were going off to fight in war, is to find an alternative to war. I think another is to find ways of living that can enable this planet to have a real future, not only for ourselves, but also for our children. I want to mention a couple of other quick quotes here, and then just round this up and invite your comments and reactions to this. He talks a lot about how what we need to do is to move into what he calls the solar age, but he is not. I think some people think that solar energy, if we did it rightly, will just permit us to continue our society as we have it and so on. Maybe that's true. Maybe there's an invention. Maybe there's somebody inventing it today that'll make that possible for us. He thinks that solar energy is not suited for a centralized, industrialized society. And so what he really talks about here is a challenge to the whole way of life that we prize. The technology, the growth, the progress, the very things we're most proud of. I can't help but think of that. If he is true, if what he says is true, and I say again, I hope it's not true, then it may be true, as the Bible says, that what is exalted among people is an abomination in the sight of God. If we are eating our house, so there's no future for God's children, then the very kind of thing that we think of in terms of progress may really be regress. And that our very progress and our great consumption of energy and resources and all of that, it may be, as some have suggested in a very strong kind of illustration, that this kind of living is like a cancer in the body of humanity. That it tends to destroy the future, even though it may, maybe that the cancer may seem to have a lot of life and it really grows and so on. A person may be unaware of it for a long time, but it holds within it the prospect not of life, but of death. And we think of that now as an image for the whole planet itself. The very last sentence of his book, he ends with the fact that we are stewards of the world. That's a very interesting kind of statement. And what he calls for is what he specifically speaks of as a second reformation. But as the Protestant Reformation theologically, just tremendous turning around of thinking and so on, we need to have a similar kind of reformation. And that that reformation, he thinks, leads to all kinds of things that just seem totally kind of far out to most of us. He thinks that what really is called for is a return to a much, much different style of life. Return back to a more simple kind of agricultural life, where the person produces, maybe you produce your own food with a hoe and with a horse instead of burning up all the petroleum and all that. Moving away from at least the kind of technological society that is using up all these resources. And I must confess, this kind of thing really boggles my mind in some ways. I think I'm not unaware of the fact that here we sit out here at Holden Village, and that my wife and I suppose, used 100 gallons of gasoline to get out here. And all right, can we use up the gasoline to come out here and tell you about all this? And I think about, there's a guy at the University of Minnesota, Dr. J. Edward Anderson, who thinks that we could run our big cities with as little as 10% of our current energy through using other methods of insulation and conservation, especially, that we could, with our changes transportation systems, that there are just tremendous ways in which we could just greatly reduce. I think most of us would be more open to those kind of concepts than we are to thinking about going back, you know, living on a little plot of ground and working with your hoe. I mean, it just seems just, you know, off the wall. And yet, the thing that keeps coming back to me as we deal with this, as we are stewards of life, and if it is true that this entropy business is something that is not just written in this book, but is written into the structure of reality itself, then at the very least, it seems to me, it's the kind of thing that we ought to be challenged by. And that as it's important for us to face our limitations personally, not live in some kind of dream world, pretending we're God or Napoleon or somebody else, so also as a human race, it is important for us to face our corporate kind of limitations. And if there is some measure of truth in this, that we should have the courage and honesty to deal with it. And as people of God in Christ who believe that we are stewards of life, to be willing to do what we can to provide a future for our children. This morning, for those of you in the Bible study, one of the questions was raised, a comment was made, that we are not likely to be asked today to lay down our life for somebody else. And yet, as I thought about this afternoon, it may be a sense in which it is true for us that we are called to live in a way of sacrifice. To love is to give yourself for someone else. In Christ, we are called to sacrifice. And maybe we are called to sacrifice. Maybe some of us, this may seem strange, maybe to sacrifice a trip to Holden Village in order that we would not waste as much. Maybe we have to find other ways of doing these things and traveling all around the country to a common site. Maybe there isn't technology, way to do that. Maybe through, you know, we could, TV and video, we can sit in a group like this and visit with each other without ever leaving home. I don't know. There's tremendous. I don't want to badmouth all technology. I think technology is a gift of God, but there is a technology which is limited in terms of the way it wastes resources, and there is technology that just gobbles it up. But anyway, I'm going to quit there, and we've got about 15 minutes by my clock, and welcome your reactions in terms of living with limitations, personal and planetary. Yes, sir.
You're told that early in the 21st century, we'll have something in the order of 8 billion people, as opposed to 4.5 billion currently. Would he have us believe that in fact there is any level of regression of lifestyles that would infinitely provide for a population base that size on this earth?
One of the things that he talks about that I didn't mention is one of the main themes of that book is that he thinks that we simply have to have limitation of population. That you simply cannot put 1,000 mice into that thing with one loaf of bread. Now that raises all kinds of questions. But he would be a very strong advocate of population limitation matters. And he hopes that those limitations can take place voluntarily. There are other things that he talks about here in terms of, you get into a situation where, you get limited resources and hungry people, and, you can just imagine what kind of structures of government and tyranny and oppression that comes out of that. They're just nightmarish kind of things to think about. I'm not sure if I get at your question exactly.
Well, simply that, I think it's too little too late for those kinds of solutions. Is he talking all about extraterrestrial colonization?
I think he believes that that is not at the present time or in the foreseeable future a realistic option.
If we go along the current rate that we are, we won't be hospitable for them. For them coming here.
Well, I think you're thinking the other way. Moving them off.
That would, of course, be a totally counter argument. That would say move technology ever faster toward the escape route.
That's right. There are people who talk in those terms. And I certainly don't have any answers here, but all I say is that I read this book and try to ponder these. And there are many other books. I'd suggest one of the theme books for the summer here is the Global 2000 Report, if you haven't taken a look at that. Suggest that. There are many other books, Small is Beautiful, Living More with Less. There's a lot of stuff here in the bookstore on this theme.
What is his religious background?
I must confess that I don't know. He speaks, it's interesting to me, in this book and also in the book The Emerging Order, he has a lot of positive things to say about people such as those who are the kind of Christians who put out Sojourners magazine and The Other Side, and some of those who are people who are very dedicated. In his book The Emerging Order, he really sees in that kind of a tremendous hope for the future. But he talks about how he thinks it can go either of two ways, maybe it could go many ways, but what he talks about is it could move in that direction, kind of the sojourner's direction, the simplified lifestyle, along the lines of the kind of things that Rifkin suggests here. Or he thinks it could also move in the direction of fascism and much increased state control, and you get into all these problems, and you know somebody has to do something, and things are out of control, and you've got to protect your resources. I have a Roman Catholic Maronite priest friend back in Minneapolis who says that one of our problems is we have too much to defend. And so you've got to defend it. You've got to build a fortress to protect what you have. And he thinks that prospect is not very cheerful. Yes?
I wonder sometimes if overabundance could be a part of this big picture. For instance, when we came up here, we drove through miles and miles of beautiful corn and wheat fields.
Yes.
And what they have developed with technology to feed the population. I have a feeling that a lot of things come into the picture, like greed and these qualities that human beings come up with that deter advancement. And they become big problems.
It was very interesting, as you mentioned, that we drove also through that same country, and we had a very interesting thing happened as we drove along that we put on, had the radio on, and we heard a program that must have gone on for about a half an hour. It was on the National Public Radio over here. We picked it up over by Spokane someplace, talking about the wheat fields of the state of Washington. And they had people on there who were wheat farmers talking about the fact that economic necessity made them farm in such a way that they realized that year after year after year they're essentially mining the soil, that there is not going to be a future for this beautiful wheat-producing country if they continue to farm in this way. And these farmers were not, they were not being arrogant or hostile. Nobody was making devils out of them. They were simply saying, this is the only way we can do it. We either have to get some help somehow, or the prices have to go up, or something has to happen. So if we're going to do the kind of soil conservation practices that we know how to practice, we know there are things we could do, but they would be, for the short run, they would be much more expensive and less productive. In the long run, they would preserve and enhance and keep the quality of the soil. Now, I don't know anything about farming in the state of Washington, but as we drove through these vast fields and looked beautiful, everything green and marvelous, it was interesting to hear that. One of the things, just one thought that ended it, that the statement of Jesus in Luke, 12:15, a person's life does not consist in the abundance of his possessions. It's almost as if Rifkin quotes that. He says we have to learn to live so that we think in terms of the quality of life and not just in terms of the quantity of goods. Yes, Mr. Harrington.
And we got into some of that situation here of encouraging people to grow certain crops because of government subsidies and so forth, rather than operating within a free economy. And at the same time, the other side of that coin, I've heard that you can't necessarily ship all this merchandise off to some of these third world countries because they're also agricultural countries, and we destroy their economy, which makes the second sin worse than the first.
There's a book called Aid is an Obstacle. Aid is used in ways that hasn't always been helpful. Mm-hmm. These are very complex. When you get into the specific kind of thing, which you should do, they're very complex, difficult questions. But the basic, and I don't want to suggest, I don't have any answers to all these things, but I think it's very important we grapple with those. I don't know what the thing in terms of the, you know, in terms of these specific wheat farmers. Now, they were making the suggestion that maybe the government or somebody ought to come in and should say, you take this land out of production now and you plant it into, I don't know what, or you do some terrace it or whatever, I don't know what you do, in such a way that you can renew it and enhance it and keep it. Others would say, you shouldn't do that at all, get out totally and let the price go up. Let people pay for the food what it's worth, and if wheat is $10 a bushel, then we could afford to be concerned about our children and grandchildren and not just about not going broke and making the mortgage payments.
We should get to a point in a free economy somewhere where these fellows find out that it is profitable perhaps to raise wheat, and there should be other products raised or something.
That's true. It's a difficult kind of thing. I don't know what the solution is. Nobody had a hand back here.
Well, right now the wheat farmers are just having to try and make the interest on their loans for their equipment.
This is what they...
There's another, though, I think kind of catastrophic thing that's going to be facing us in terms of food, and that is the water situation, which is facing us within the next 200 or 100 years anyway. And my father was always very willing to use things. He was a farmer and had known, you know, privation in his earlier years because they started their farms with stumps. But now in his later years, very eager to just, you know, well, we'll just use it up and use it up and use it up. And I said, well, we really need to conserve things. And he didn't see that from his viewpoint. And yet if we don't start conserving a lot of things, there's not going to be anything left.
The thing that struck me as I heard this program is that these farmers did see it.
Yeah,
they said, we see it is true. We don't. We'd like to leave a productive farm for our children and grandchildren, but if I don't farm this way, I'm going to lose the farm. I'll go broke.
We have water. The Midwest isn't going to have water. We've got water table going down. And that's, I don't know who's facing that one either. But we don't have much soil in the Eastern Washington. It's not very.
These are difficult kind of problems. You talk even back in Iowa, they talk about the topsoil is so, you know, how many feet thick in some places, but then they come in and calculate and say at the continued rate. If you look ahead a ways, look ahead 100 years from now, what's it going to be? Nobody knows, of course, but as stewards of life, I mean, this is a spiritual question. Other comments? That's my hand over here. Somebody. Yes, sir.
There's no doubt that we're a dying planet with the air pollution. And soil, what is it, about 5 billion tons of soil is eroded every year?
Those figures are all, he has some figures in this to talk about some of that, and yet there we know ways to deal with, at least to greatly conserve.
It could probably be turned around if we start doing it now, but as I see it, that's where we're dying planet. If the bomb doesn't get us, well then the rest of them will get it.
I don't think the bomb is a very cheerful solution to the problem.
Well, that's what I expect from one of the early comments I made. Does he literally suggest that it's possible to turn it around in light of where we are?
He thinks that if people would really face up to the realities of things, he calls it, as I said, it's a second reformation. It is a revolutionary kind of approach to these questions. I don't think he's certainly not an optimist. He thinks that time is short, but he does think that there is time enough, a generation or two perhaps, in which if people would really take a hard look at this and deal with it, if we had enough Joseph, so to speak, to give us leadership and people would be challenged to sacrifice and to act in love and live out that stewardship, he thinks it is not yet too late.
But is he talking to Americans as opposed to Indians, Chinese?
I think he's talking to the whole world. I don't think he's just, he's a very kind of even-handed in that sense. He thinks this is something that the socialist, communist countries, capitalist countries, everybody has to deal with this one because it really is kind of a basic problem all over the place.
So how does he get their attention, by talking to us?
You got to start where you are. I don't know. He hopes that there are people over there that would have realism enough to see what they're doing and walk across their fields and see what's happening and see the energy problems and so on, that recognize that there are things that can be done. Now, there are, as I say, one of the difficulties is that there are a lot of people on the other side of this question who are of this. I quote that little blurb on that book from Forbes magazine, and who really say that's the best thing we ever heard is simply don't worry about it. Everything's going to be all right. Human beings have intelligence and ingenuity. We've always solved our problems. I personally think that whatever is true on that score, I hope that's true. I hope they can solve it. And maybe through development of some new solar techniques or fusion instead of fission with all the problems. Maybe there are some solutions here, but at the same time, it strikes me that that attitude, that as human beings we can do anything, in theological terms there's a word for that. That's called idolatry. That is, we think we can do anything. It's the same thing in my own personal life, living with limitations. If I don't face the fact that I'm a mortal, weak sinner, one day, sooner or late, to die, there's something wrong in my head and in my heart. I've made a god out of myself. And the same thing if we think, as human beings, we can solve everything. We are, again, to use that old quote, masters of our fate and captains of our soul. I think that's not only whistling in the dark, it's theologically idolatrous. It's idolatry of human imagination and capability. Yeah.
Well, maybe the ingenuity that the human beings need to come up with to solve this problem is the same general scheme of ingenuity that we need to solve our nuclear bomb problem, meaning a political hierarchy with teeth in it that we talked about this morning.
I think that these things are very closely related. It seems to me we're talking, we talk about, as I mentioned, for me, this whole concept of stewardship of life, kind of as an umbrella over all of these things, brings them together, that those two things are very much intertwined together. I heard the bell. If you get some good solutions on this, let me know. If you want a challenge for life, here's one that should keep you busy for a while. Thank you for coming.